answer. There wasn't a person on Earth who could accurately catalog the contents of their console and glove compartment. He stood up, feeling himself sweat beneath the collar of his shirt. He was supposed to canvass the area to see who might have heard or seen something, but he was literally 6 miles from the nearest exit, and the only visible evidence of humanity was a giant Confederate flag that snapped in the wind across the highway, towering over the tree line as a reminder or a threat, depending on your politics. Hugh set his hands on his hips and jutted his chin toward the flag. "Well," he demanded out loud, "would you like to give an eyewitness report?" Deciding that he'd done due diligence, Hugh started back to his own car. He had to burn all these stupid photos to disk and do a shit ton of paperwork now. True, nothing was going to come of this case. They'd never find the thieves, but even if it sucked, he was going to do the right thing. This mantra was as much a part of Hugh as his height or his hair color or his lineage. True, this had not been his intended career path, but then he'd met Annabelle, and they'd gotten pregnant. Somehow, instead of tracking the movements of the stars at NASA, he had wound up tracking the movements of the residents of Jackson, Mississippi. He had watched Columbo like every other kid in the 80s, and detective work had seemed an exciting backup plan. Well, the joke was on Hugh. He wasn't thwarting jewel heists. He was dusting for fingerprints on a gas cap. His cell phone buzzed in his pocket and he answered, thinking it might be the owner of the vehicle. He'd left a message that morning for the kid. "McElroy," he said. "Hugh." His eyes closed. He'd conjured Annabelle just by thinking of her.
"You weren't who I was expecting," he said.
And in the silence that followed, he turned over the implications of that sentence. Her voice sounded like filigree, delicate and irreplicable, with a hint of a French accent that he supposed was cultivated after years of living in a foreign country.
"I wasn't going to forget your 40th," Annabelle said. "How are you?"
He looked around at his surroundings, the looming Confederate flag, the trampled, knee-high grass, the scraped and dented car. Instead of giving an answer even he wouldn't want to hear, he turned his back away from the highway.
"What time is it there?"
he asked, squinting into the sun. She laughed. God, he'd loved that sound. He remembered playing the fool sometimes, leaving a shaving cream mustache intentionally on his upper lip when he came downstairs in the morning, just to hear it. When had he stopped making her smile?
"It's quitting time," Annabelle said.
"Lucky you."
There was a bubble of silence. Amazing to think that she was so far away, and he could still hear the hesitation in her voice.
"How is she?"
Hugh exhaled.
"She's good."
Annabelle had agreed to give him custody of Wren because, she said, that way Wren could be as comfortable as possible. If her parents were splitting up, at least she got to stay at home with her friends and her father. Hugh had always believed that her magnanimous gesture was a result of guilt. She knew she had cheated. As a consolation prize, she left Hugh the best part of their marriage.
"Are you happy, Hugh?"
Annabelle asked. He forced a laugh.
"What kind of question is that?"
"I don't know. A Parisian one. An existential one."
He imagined her with her long red hair, a waterfall that used to slip through his hands. He could still see her face when he closed his eyes. The pale eyebrows she had darkened with a pencil, the way her eyes darted left when she lied, how she bit her lower lip when he made love to her. When you lost someone, how much time had to pass before the details began to fade?
or at least the feeling that you had an unfinished edge that might unravel at any moment, until you were nothing more than a tangle of the person you used to be.
You don't have to worry about me, Hugh said.
Of course I do, Annabelle replied, because you're too busy worrying about everyone else. There were 7,500 miles between them, and Hugh felt claustrophobic.
I gotta go.
Oh, of course, Annabelle said quickly. It's good to hear your voice, Hugh.
You too. I'll tell Ren you called, he promised, although they both knew he wouldn't.
The relationship between Ren and her mother was more complicated than the one between him and Annabelle. He felt the way he did when he misplaced something important, a little angry at himself, a little frustrated. Ren felt like she'd been the important thing that was misplaced.
Take care of yourself, Hugh said,
his subtle way of acknowledging that her new lover couldn't do a good job of that and she was on her own. He hung up, savoring his small and lovely victory of a sentence. At precisely 9:01 a.m., Ren popped out of her chair and walked up to Ms. Beckett, the health teacher. Everyone was taking a test that involved labeling the parts of the male and female reproductive systems, with points taken off if you spelled fallopian or vas deferens wrong. Ms. Beckett was pretty cool, as teachers went. She was young and had married the hot gym teacher, Mr. Hanlon, last year. Although Ms. Beckett hadn't officially told anyone yet, it was clear from her ever-loosening wardrobe of jumpers and caftans that she was going to need a long-term sub in a few months while she was on maternity leave. There was a poetic justice to that, Ren thought, a sex ed teacher who had gotten pregnant. It was also why she knew that if she walked up to Ms. Beckett's desk and told her the truth, she needed to leave school to get the pill, the teacher would probably have covered Ren's tracks for her. But it wasn't like contraception was a valid excuse for getting out of class. So she did the next best thing when Ms. Beckett looked up from her computer. She screwed her face into a grimace of abject pain and whispered, "Cramps." The magic word. 30 seconds later, she was walking through the school with a pass to the nurse. Except instead of turning right to go to the nurse's office, she made an abrupt left and walked out the door near the foreign language wing, letting the hot sun scald her. She reached for her phone and texted, and 10 seconds later, Aunt Bex's car pulled up to the curb. Ren yanked open the door and slipped into the passenger seat just as one of the school safety officers rounded the corner of the building. "Go," she urged. "Go, go!" Aunt Bex screamed away from the curb. "Lord," she said as her tires squealed, "I feel like Thelma and Louise." Ren turned to her blankly. "Who?" "My God, you make me feel like a dinosaur," Aunt Bex laughed. She reached behind her, fumbling around the back seat until she grabbed a paper bag, which she dropped into Ren's lap. Ren didn't even have to open it to know it was donuts. She supposed that it was moments like this when it paid to have a mother around. But to be honest, her mom was so extra. Living in an artist's commune or something in the Marais, and getting piercings in places where not even Ren would want them. Aunt Bex wasn't the next best thing. She was better. Ren slouched in the seat and put her feet on the dashboard. "Don't do that," Aunt Bex said automatically, although it was hard to imagine how this old beater of a car could be damaged in any way by the footprint of Ren's shoe. There were paint rags on the back seat, and empty buckets and dust from stretched canvases, and everything smelled a little like turpentine. "Go ahead," Ren said.
"Go ahead?"
"Give me the lecture. What is it you always say? A free lunch isn't ever really free." Aunt Bex shook her head. "Nope." This lunch has no strings attached.
Ren sat up, tilting her head.
Really?
Her aunt was the only person who seemed to understand you couldn't schedule when you fell in love, like it was a doctor's appointment.
Aunt Bex?
Ren blurted.
How come you never got married?
Her aunt shrugged. I'm sure the story you're hoping for is much more romantic than the truth. I just didn't. That's all. She glanced in her niece's direction. I'm not taking you here today because of some unrequited love of my own, Bex said. I'm taking you because I'd rather you have the pill than an abortion.
Ren reached into the paper bag and took a bite of her donut.
Have I told you that I love you?
Her aunt raised a brow. Because I'm taking you to the center or because I got you chocolate cream?
Ren grinned.
Can it be both? She asked.
When Olive went to kiss Peg goodbye, she found her wife underneath the sink trying to fix the trash disposal. She took in the sight for a moment, admiring the wriggle of Peg's hips and the swell of her breasts as she reached up to do something to a pipe. Hell, Olive might be old, but she wasn't dead yet.
How did I get so lucky? She mused out loud. Marrying a plumber, and a hot one at that.
You married an engineer with plumbing skills.
Peg slipped out from the cabinet, and a hot one at that. Peg smiled up at her. Olive wanted to memorize every detail of their life together. The chip in Peg's front tooth, the lip of pink sock peeking out from her tennis shoe, the orange juice sweating on the counter, and the newel post of the banister that fell off its perch weekly, no matter how much wood glue they used. The scatter of pens near the phone, tossed like runes that were all out of ink. There was such art in the ordinary, it could leave you in tears.
Where are you off to today so early anyway?
Peg asked, sticking her head back underneath the sink. Olive hadn't told Peg about going to the oncologist's office last week. She had hid the file with the confusion of numbers and tests underneath the mattress, where Peg wouldn't find it. It was tucked inside her purse now, for the nurse at the center to interpret. But did Olive really need the translation? She knew. Even if she needed someone else to say it to make it true.
A checkup, no big deal.
Olive heard the throaty growl of the disposal and Peg's arpeggio of laughter.
God, she had danced to the music of that laugh for a decade now. She felt like an explorer moving through a world she had always known, charged with cataloging the minutiae of the common, the grooves of the routine, just in case 1,000 years from now someone else wanted to see things exactly as they had looked through her eyes. The way her hand slipped seamlessly into Peg's in the dark of a movie theater when they didn't have to worry if anyone might be shocked by two old women in love. The long silver hair coiled into the shape of infinity in the shower drain. The cool, possessive stamp of her kiss. What she would miss were these details. She wondered if, when you left this world, you got to take a certain number of them deep in your pockets, clenched in your fists, or tucked high on the roof of your mouth, with you forever. When Louis wasn't performing abortions, he was teaching new doctors how to do them. He was an associate professor at the University of Hawaii and Boston University. He started his semesters the same way, telling the students that over 5,000 years ago in ancient China, mercury was used to induce abortions, although it most likely also killed the women. The Ebers Papyrus from 1500 BC mentioned abortions. He showed a slide of a bas-relief from the year 1150, decorating the temple of Angkor Wat in Cambodia, where a woman in the underworld was getting an abortion at the hands of a demon.
He told his medical students that Aristophanes mentioned pennyroyal tea as an abortifacient. Just 5 grams of it could be toxic. That Pliny the Elder said if a woman didn't want a pregnancy, she could step over a viper or ingest rue. Hippocrates suggested that a woman who wanted to miscarry jump and hit herself on the bottom with her heels until the embryo released and fell out. If that didn't work, there was always a mixture of mouse dung, honey, Egyptian salt, resin, and wild colocynth that you could insert into the uterus. A Sanskrit manuscript from the 8th century recommended sitting over a pot of boiling water or steaming onions. Scribonius Largus, the court doctor for Emperor Claudius, had a recipe that included mandrake root, opium, Queen Anne's lace, a papanax, and peppers. Tertullian, the Christian theologian, described instruments that matched the ones used today for a D&E, and said Hippocrates, Asclepiades, Erasistratus, Herophilus, and Serenus all employed them. Abortion had been around, Louis told them, since the beginning of time. I got a new one for you, Dr. Ward, Vanita said as he wandered into the reception area during a 5-minute break. Tansy. She a patient? Vanita laughed. No, it's an herb or a flower or something. It was used in the Middle Ages to abort. He grinned. Where'd you learn that? Reading one of my romance novels, she said. I didn't think romance novels covered that topic. Well, what else you think is going to happen with all that sex? He laughed. Vanita was one of his favorite people in the world. She had run the clinic since 1989, when the previous owner had retired. She painted it orange because she wanted it to stand out proud, like it had on its best Sunday clothes. Vanita had grown up in Silver Grove, cinched tight in the Bible Belt, and her mama was a devout Baptist. When Vanita opened the clinic, the church here had contacted her mama to let her know what her wayward daughter was doing. Vanita Jean, her mother had said on the telephone, don't tell me you're opening an abortion clinic. Then mama don't ask me, Vanita had replied. How busy am I gonna be today? Louis asked. Do I look like a crystal ball? You look like the person who does the scheduling. She grunted. Well, I hope you ate a big breakfast today, 'cause it may also be your lunch. Louis grinned. It would be busy. It was always busy. He'd already started his first case. In fact, a woman in her second trimester who needed her cervix softened before the procedure. She'd be the first and the last patient he saw that morning. The waiting room already had women in it who were here for their counseling sessions, who would come back tomorrow for their procedures. They came from Natchez and Tupelo and from around the corner. They came from Alligator and Satartia and Starkville and Wiggins. There were 48,000 square miles of Mississippi, and this was the only clinic at which you could get an abortion. You might have to drive 5 hours to get there, and, of course, you had to wait 24 hours between counseling and the procedure, which meant more travel expenses that many desperate women couldn't afford. Vanita had on speed dial the names of benefactors and organizations she could call when a woman showed up who didn't have money for lunch or bus fare home, much less enough for a procedure. And then there were the women who had to be referred to other states because the center only performed abortions up to 16 weeks. Vanita was emptying one of the blessing bags that the protesters handed out to the patients, who often, bewildered, turned them in at the reception desk. I've got 3 sets of booties, she said, but I'm holding out for a little hat. She glanced up. You do the cytotech? I did indeed, Louis replied. Vanita held up a little hand-printed card from
from the blessing bag. "Defund Planned Parenthood," she read. "You think they know we're not a Planned Parenthood?" It was like using the word Xerox instead of copy machine. Plus, federal funds already were legally prohibited from being used for abortions. They covered gynecological care. Abortions were self-funding. In fact, they were the only procedure reproductive health services clinics offered that didn't operate at a loss. If Planned Parenthood was defunded, it wouldn't stop abortions. Abortions would literally be the only things they could afford to do. Sometimes, Louis felt like they only existed in relation to the antis. If they all disappeared, would he go up in a puff of smoke? Could you stand for something if there wasn't an opposition? He watched Vanita sweep the contents of the blessing bag into a trash can. "Ladies, who's waiting on labs?" A peppering of hands went up. Vanita pressed a button on her phone and summoned Harriet to come get the next wave of patients for their blood tests. She did this fluidly and seamlessly. It was like watching a conductor raise beauty from the discord of an orchestra.
"Hey, Vanita," Louis said, "you ever think about taking a vacation?"
She didn't even spare him a glance. "I'll take one when you do, Dr. Ward." The phone rang and she answered it, already dismissing him. "Yes, honey," Vanita said. "You've got the right place." In a small bank of chairs beside the lab, Joy sat with her earbuds firmly jammed into her ears, listening to her Disney playlist while the cytotech did its work inside her. It would take a few hours before her cervix was soft enough to be dilated, which meant that she would be in the center for a while other women came and went. She shifted, slipping a crumpled picture out of her pocket. Yesterday, she had been one of a dozen women here for counseling, getting labs done and listening to Vanita walk through the forms required by the state and hearing Dr. Ward talk about the procedure. She had also been asked to give a urine sample and had an ultrasound. A woman named Graciela had been the one who performed it. She had hair that reached past her hips, and even though her voice was soft, she was speaking by rote. "We are obligated to offer you the opportunity to listen to the fetal heartbeat and to see the sonogram," Graciela told her, and to Joy's surprise, she heard herself say yes. Then she started to sob. She cried for her own dumb luck, for her loneliness. She cried because even though she had taken every precaution possible, she had wound up, like her mother, boxed into bad choices because of a man. Graciela had handed her a tissue and then squeezed her hands. "Are you sure you want to do this?" she asked, breaking from the script. Although she wasn't talking about the ultrasound, she put the wand back in its cradle.
"I'm sure," Joy said, but she didn't know if she believed it.
Peeing on a stick was not seeing a fetus on a sonogram.
"I want to see it,"
she told Graciela. So Graciela squirted gel onto her swollen belly and ran the wand over her skin, and abracadabra, a silver fish swam on to the little screen. It morphed into a circle, a curve, then a fetal shape.
"Can I?" Joy said, and then she swallowed. "Can I have a picture?"
"You bet," Graciela replied. She pushed a button and a little printout curled from the machine, black and white, in profile. She handed it to Joy.
"You must think I'm crazy,"
Joy murmured. Graciela shook her head.
"You'd be surprised how many women want one."
Joy had not known what to do with the ultrasound picture. She only knew she could not leave without it. She didn't want to fold it into her tiny wallet and yesterday she had been wearing pants without pockets, so she had slipped it into her bra, over her heart. She told herself that when she got home later, she would crumple it up and throw it away. She still had it with her today. Beth felt like she was swimming up from the bottom of a deep pool, and every time she tried to see the runny yolk of the sun, it seemed to get farther away. Then suddenly she surfaced in a rush of noise and activity. She was dizzy and dry-mouthed when her eyes popped open. Where the hell was she? She slipped a hand underneath the blanket that was covering her and touched her belly, then lower, to the bulk of a pad in her underwear. Awareness struck her, one drop at a time, until suddenly she was soaked in the truth. They had asked her if she was pregnant, and she'd said no, and it didn't squeeze her heart to say it because it wasn't a lie. But still, they had done a urine test and a blood test and had rubbed an ultrasound wand over her belly, as if they didn't believe her. The last thing Beth remembered was looking up at the ugly fluorescent lights on the ceiling, and then she didn't remember anything at all. She tried to speak, but she had to dig deeper to find her voice, and when it came out, it didn't sound like hers at all.
"Daddy," she rasped.
Then he was leaning over her, his warm hands on her shoulder, her arm.
"Hi, baby girl," he said.
He smiled down at her, and she noticed the deep lines that bracketed his mouth, like a parenthetical statement of fear. His temples had brown age spots she had never seen before. When had he gotten old, and why hadn't she noticed?
"Where am I?"
He smoothed her hair away from her face.
"You're at the hospital. You're going to be fine, honey. You just rest."
"What happened?"
He looked down at the floor.
"You were losing a lot of blood. You needed a transfusion. Whatever it is, baby, we're going to get through this together."
Beth wished that could be true. She wished in a crazy way that the doctor would come back and tell her she had a rare and terrible cancer, because that would almost be easier to hear than the fact that she had disappointed her father. He reached over, averting his eyes, tugging her hospital Johnny more firmly behind her to tuck it in.
"Don't need to give a free show," he murmured.
She had read somewhere that the victims of the Inquisition had been made to pay for their own punishments, their own imprisonment. To escape death, they had to offer up the names of others who did not believe Jesus Christ was God. Whether or not they were actually innocent had nothing to do with the process. Beth took a deep breath.
"Daddy," she began,
and just then the nurse came into the room. She was round everywhere, cheeks, butt, boobs, belly, and she smelled like cinnamon. Beth remembered hazily that face leaning down over her own.
"I'm Jayla, I'm your nurse, and I'm gonna take care of you. Understand?"
"It's about time," her father said. "It can't be normal, that much blood from there. Is my daughter gonna be all right?"
Jayla looked from Beth to her father.
"Maybe I could talk to Beth privately."
That was the instant that Beth understood her day of judgment had come, her moment before the Grand Inquisitor. But her father didn't know this, and so he interpreted her sudden stiffness as fear instead of fatalism.
"You can talk to us both. She's only 17.
Her father gripped her hand as if he could be the strength for whatever bad news was about to be delivered. Was it Beth's imagination, or did Jayla's eyes soften as they met hers, as if she could couch the impact of her words?
"Beth, your tests came back. Did you know you were pregnant?"
No,
she whispered, a syllable that was maybe a lie and maybe a denial of what was surely about to happen. Beth could not look her father in the eye. He lifted her hand, and for a breathless moment, she thought that she had been wrong about him, that he would stand by her, or forgive her, or both. But instead, he tugged, until she could feel his thumb rubbing over the thin ridge of the silver promise ring he had bought her for her 14th birthday, the one that was supposed to signify that she'd stay pure until her wedding night.
Are you? Did you?
The nurse murmured something and slipped out through the curtains of the cubicle. Beth hardly even noticed. She was somewhere else, behind a playing field, under the bleachers, with stars overhead that spelled out the answers to questions she was afraid to ask out loud.
Should I? What if he... Could this be? Yes. Yes. Yes.
For one night, she had been worshipped. A boy had lit fires inside her in places she had not known could burn. He had prayed with his hands and his mouth and his promises, and she had made a single mistake. She had put her faith in him. Even after everything he had done, she had turned the memory of that night over and over in her mind until it was so smooth and polished it was no longer an irritating grain of sand, but a pearl. She had to see it that way, because if it wasn't rare and special, then she was an even greater fool. But her father wouldn't think that. She had believed that nothing could ever hurt more than the moment she realized John Smith was not a real name, that she had willingly given away something she could never get back. Not just her virginity, but her pride. But this? This cut more deeply. The look on her father's face when he realized Beth was damaged goods.
Please, Daddy, she begged. It wasn't my fault.
He seized on that escape hatch.
Then who did this to you? Who hurt you?
She pictured John's lips grazing the inside of her thigh, his mouth closing over her.
No one,
she said softly. Her father clenched his fists.
I'll kill him. I will kill him for laying a hand on you.
His words were full of angles and edges.
Who is he?
For a moment, Beth almost laughed. Good luck finding him, she thought. But instead of directing her fury at whoever John Smith was, she turned the full force of her blaze on her father instead.
This is why I couldn't tell you.
Her own voice scared her with its true and perfect aim.
It's why I went to the clinic in the first place, because I knew you'd be like this.
Her anger shook the curtains. Her fingernails bit into her own palms. She was a hydra. Her father had cut her down, and something twice as strong had grown in its place. Somewhere, distantly, Beth realized that it had not been sleeping with a boy that had made her a woman. It was not even the pregnancy or trying to remove it. It was this. Being forcibly treated like a child when she wasn't one. Her father stared at her.
I don't even know who you are,
he said softly. And then he turned on his heel and left. Janine knew part of the disguise of being a woman who wanted an abortion involved fooling her own tribe. She and Alan had talked about this, how it was safer, how it was almost a quality control checkpoint before she entered the center. If she could get by the other pro-life activists with her blonde wig and her hoodie pulled up to shadow her face, then she could likely convince the employees inside. Plus,
If she walked past everyone and they didn't call out to her the way they would any other woman, it might look suspicious. So the only person who knew who she was as she walked for the first time on the other side of the fence was Alan. He met her gaze and then turned away to talk to another activist. Meanwhile, the others began trying to get her attention. She knew that the center considered this harassment, but honestly, it was good citizenship. If you saw a murder in progress, wouldn't you stop it? Good morning, Ethel said, stretching her hand over the fence with a little pink bag dangling from her fingers. Can I offer you a gift? Janine felt her heart pound. She couldn't speak. What if Ethel recognized her voice? Instead, she reached out and snatched the blessing bag. You don't have to go through with this, Ethel said triumphantly. Janine knew why. If you could actually get one of the women to take a bag, you had already gotten into her head. We can help. Turning away, Janine rang the buzzer at the center's front door, and 2 seconds later she heard the buzz that would let her enter. There were maybe 10 other women sitting in the waiting room, young and old, calm and jittery, black and white. The woman at the reception desk had a name tag, Vanita. Janine gave her alias, Fiona, and watched Vanita highlight her name on a list. Then she checked her watch. You're the last one, she said. Let's get you in for a quick lab test, and you can do the ultrasound after counseling so we don't hold up the process. It means you'll have to stay afterward, but only for a few minutes. Sound good? But Janine said nothing. She had expected the nerves that would make it difficult to be a spy. She had not expected the PTSD, the sudden wave that knocked her off her feet and made her see not this clinic owner and this reception desk, but one she'd visited long ago, in a different state. I'm gonna take that as a yes, Vanita said, smiling. She patted Janine's hand. I know you're nervous, but I promise you we'll get you through. Janine was whisked into the back to have her blood tested for her Rh type and to give a urine sample. Janine's was in her purse in a little baby food jar. Alan had gotten it from someone who knew someone who was pregnant, and she hadn't asked any questions. In the bathroom, she poured it from the jar into the specimen cup. When she entered the waiting room, Vanita was just starting the counseling session. She sat down between a woman whose eyes were so heavy-lidded she might have been asleep and a woman who was taking notes diligently in a spiral notebook. I run this clinic, Vanita was saying, and I am glad you found your way to us. Now, we're going to spend a few moments together, and then the doctor is going to come talk to you as a group. And then you're going to have a chance to meet one-on-one with him. As she spoke, she walked around the semicircle of seating, handing out clipboards with paperwork. All of you have a file, yes? On the top is a prescription for azithromycin, which is given to you prophylactically so you don't get any type of infection. I need you to get that filled and bring it with you when you return for your procedure. She looked around, making eye contact with each woman to make sure they understood. The sheet underneath that prescription is what we're going to work on first. It's your 24-hour informed consent. Mississippi law says that you can have an abortion 24 hours after completing this counseling session. This form signifies that you have made 2 visits, the first one being today. We're going to fill out the areas marked with X's to document that you're here for your first visit. So, take your pens and let's all do this together. Janine blindly followed the instructions, making up a fake address for her fake persona and scribbling the date and a signature. The woman beside Janine, who was taking notes, held up her hand. What about the time? Dr. Ward will fill that part out for you when you meet with him.
Vanita held up a fan made of brightly colored pamphlets.
These are booklets that the Department of Health requires us to give to our patients. The first one gives alternatives to abortion, like programs for unwed mothers and licensed maternity homes and adoption information. And it tells you where the health departments are located all over the state. The second booklet shows you how a fetus develops from beginning to end of a pregnancy. The third booklet tells you what your risks are when you have an abortion, as well as when you have a baby. And the last one is my favorite. It's about contraception. Everyone but Janine laughed. Today is the day you need to decide what kind of contraception you'd like to have when you leave here.
This surprised Janine. She had known that the center was a murder factory, but not that they also tried to prevent pregnancies. She pressed down so hard on her mechanical pencil that the lead broke.
Now, please sign and date the form to acknowledge you were given these materials.
There was a tired thread in Vanita's voice, as if this were a script she had memorized long ago.
The second portion of this page will be filled out when you come back. You'll have to reaffirm your decision by signing again. Any questions yet?
A few women shook their heads. The others just sat in silence.
We do two types of abortions here at the center, Vanita said, and Janine leaned forward on the edge of her chair. There's the surgical abortion, which the doctor performs, and there is the pill, the medical abortion, which is an option if you are 10 weeks pregnant or less.
Which one's the fastest?
A woman blurted out.
Girl, Vanita chided gently, I'm getting to that. If you decide to have a surgical abortion, you'll be here for 3 to 4 hours, although the surgery itself is less than 5 minutes from the time you go into the operating room till the time you come out. You recover for about a half hour, and then our nurse will give you discharge information, both verbally and in writing, about how to take care of yourself, along with a phone number to call for emergencies and a date to return for a checkup. Surgery patients, if you return for a checkup, it's $15 for the pregnancy test and $30 if you see the doctor. What I suggest you consider is you give yourself 3 weeks, then go to your regular physician for a checkup, and you get a pregnancy test from the pharmacy and do it yourself. You should have a light line or a clear result, and if you do, you can go on your birth control method.
A young woman with beads in her hair that sang asked,
Does it hurt?
Everyone perked up, listening carefully for the answer.
Yes,
Janine thought. She felt herself sinking backward into the darkest corner of her mind, the vault where she kept the memory of her own procedure. It hurt in all sorts of places when you least expected it.
There is some discomfort, Vanita answered. We suggest that you take deep breaths in and out. There will be a nurse in the room to help you get through the process. It's doable, that's what I can tell you. But it's also not a garden party. She surveyed the group. Now, pill patients, when you come in, you will be here for an hour and a half. You'll be in a room like this, a few of you at a time. The doctor will give you the first pill, which stops your pregnancy from growing and tells your body and your brain that you're about to abort. Then he will send you home with 4 pills in a little package. 24 hours after you've taken the first pill here at the center, you are eligible to take those other 4 pills. There's a window, so if you're at work at noon the next day, stay at work and then take the pills when you get home. You'll bleed for about 3 weeks. It takes that long for your hormone level to go back to its natural state. And after that, you come for your checkup.
Which one do you recommend?
Only you can decide, Vanita said.
If you are 10 weeks along or less and are eligible for the pills, you get to avoid surgery. But surgery is over and done with more quickly than the pill procedure, so really, it is up to you. Janine found herself thinking of her brother Ben. He lived in a group home now, and he bagged groceries for a living. He had a Down syndrome girlfriend he took out to dinner and a movie every Friday night. He was obsessed with Stranger Things. He had the same Sara Lee pound cake every night for his dessert. He was happy. On the other hand, was she? She had devoted her livelihood to saving innocent babies, but was that out of faith or guilt? She glanced around the room and wondered how many of these women would have their abortions and feel like a burden had been lifted, and how many, like her, would let it govern the rest of their lives. But she said none of this. She forced her attention to Vanita again. Now, after I finish up talking, the doctor is going to come out here and talk to you as a group. He's going to explain exactly what he does in the surgery and exactly how he administers the pill. If you have any questions, you can ask him at that time. If you have any private questions, you can ask him after that, during the individual session he has with you. During that time, he will say what the law requires him to say to you. He'll review your ultrasound and your medical history, and he'll sign off on your paperwork. Then you'll go to the reception desk and schedule when you're coming back. I'll tell you how much you owe and who your doctor is going to be the day you return. She tidied the stack of paperwork on her lap. Questions. How do you do it? Janine thought. How do you counsel this when you know they will leave here completely different women than when they arrived? She looked around at the other women. How can I save all their babies? How can I tell them that the decision they make today might not feel right tomorrow? But she said none of this. Can I work the next day? Someone asked. Yes, Vanita assured her. Do you need a doctor's note for an absence today? No, ma'am. Vanita nodded. She looked around the room. We hope you are not here because anyone has forced you to come. We are required to tell you that you do not have to go through with this procedure if you don't want to. From beneath lowered lashes, Janine held her breath. What if she stood up now and said she was making a mistake? What if she blew her cover and told these women that they needed to think of their unborn children? What if she became their voice? But she did not, and no woman wavered. Izzy was stuck in traffic at a construction zone, so by the time she got to the center, the trip had taken a half hour longer than it should have. She parked lopsided and grabbed her purse and locked the doors to the car as she was running up the path that led to the center's front door. She didn't even hear the protesters. That's how frazzled she was. When she was buzzed inside, a man in scrubs was just settling down in a cluster of women, starting to speak. The woman at the front desk took one look at Izzy and started to laugh. Sugar, she said, take a deep breath. What can I do for you? Izzy did. Hi, I'm so sorry I'm late, she began, and she realized that could be interpreted in so many different ways, and that they would all be right. Louis called it the law of three. Most of what he told these ladies had also been said by Ms. Vanita, and he would repeat it to them yet again in the individual doctor-patient sessions that followed. But he also knew that these women were too shell-shocked to be absorbing even a fraction of the information, which is why, by the third time, he hoped that it had sunk in. There were 11 women in front of him, 7 black, 2 white, 2 brown. He paid attention to the race of those who came to the center, because for him, the politics of abortion had so much in common with the politics of racism. As an African-American male, he could imagine quite easily what it was like
to not have jurisdiction over your body. White men had once owned black men's bodies. Now, white men wanted to own women's bodies.
I am obligated by the state to tell you some things that are not medically true, Louis said. I am obligated to tell you that having an abortion increases your risk for breast cancer, even though there is no evidence to support that.
He thought back, as he always did, to the patient he had treated once who had breast cancer and who had terminated her pregnancy so that she could pursue treatment. My risk of getting breast cancer is zero, she had said flatly, since I already have it.
I am obligated by the state, he continued, to tell you that with abortion, there are risks of injury to your bowel, bladder, uterus, fallopian tubes, and ovaries. And that if you have injury to your uterus that's severe enough, we might have to remove your uterus, which is called a hysterectomy. But guess what? Those are the exact same risks that you'll have if you give birth to a baby. In fact, you're more likely to have those risks giving birth to a child than having an abortion. Now, y'all got questions for me?
A woman's hand crept up tentatively. I heard you use knives and scissors to cut up the babies. Louis heard this at least every other counseling session. One of the things he wished he could tell women who wanted abortions was to never, ever Google the word. He shook his head. There are no knives, no scissors, no scalpels. He made sure to correct her use of the term babies as gently as possible. If patients want to see the tissue after it's removed, they can, and it is disposed of with respect in an appropriate legal way. She nodded, satisfied. Not for the first time, Louis was amazed that a woman who believed nonsense like this would still be brave enough to schedule an appointment. He looked into the eyes of each of the women. Warriors. Every one of them. Every day he was reminded of their grit, their courage in the face of obstacles, the quiet grace with which they shouldered their troubles. They were stronger than any men he'd ever known. For sure, they were stronger than the male politicians who were so terrified of them that they designed laws specifically to keep women down. Louis shook his head, as if that could ever be done. If he had learned anything during his years as an abortion doctor, it was this. There was nothing on God's green earth that would stop a woman who didn't want to be pregnant. There was a stuffed lobster on George's daughter's bed. It was red and wore a little white hat like a Victorian baby, and he had won it for Lil at a church fair. He sat in her room the way he used to every night when he tucked her in, before she told him she could read her own books, thank you very much. She had been 7 at the time. He remembered laughing about it with Pastor Mike. He didn't find it funny now. In retrospect, it seemed like the first step on a path that would ultimately take her so far away from him, he couldn't even see her in the distance. She had wanted that lobster so bad that he paid more than $30 to a huckster to get 3 baseballs he could pitch into rusty milk cans. The first time he won, he was handed a little stuffed snake the size of a pencil. Damn bait and switch. But Lil had been next to him, clapping every time he got one in, and so he traded up until he got to the stuffed animal of her choice. The fact that she still had it after all these years was a testament, he supposed, to what it meant to her. Or maybe she hadn't wanted to let go of her childhood any more than he did. When she was little, every Saturday morning in the summertime, they'd drive out in his truck to get crawfish. Lil would curl up next to him on the bench seat, her legs dangling and kicking because her feet were nowhere close to hitting the floor. Happy feet, he'd called them. There was a creek that was shallow enough even for a 5-year-old, and he and Lil would grab a bucket from the back seat, take off their shoes and socks, and wade in. He taught her how to find the rocks that would make good hiding spots. If you lifted the stones too fast, you would startle the crawfish and stir up the mud so they scurried away. If you lifted the stone slow, you would be able to surprise the crawfish. You could pick it up with your hands then, minding the pinchers. If they had a good day hunting, Lil would help him boil them in a broth made of onions, lemon, and garlic. They'd eat them with potatoes and corn on the cob until they fell asleep in the lazy slant of the afternoon, bellies full and fingers still slick with butter. Once, Lil had lifted one of the crawfish to find rows of little red eggs stuck underneath her tail.
"Daddy," she had asked, "what's wrong with her?"
"She's gonna have babies," George had explained, "so we have to put her back and let her do just that. You don't mess with the mama, Lil. She belongs with her babies."
Lil had been quiet for a moment.
"Daddy," she'd asked, "who messed with my mama?"
He had scooped his girl up and out of the water.
"Let's get home before the crawdads get out of that pail," he'd said,
because he couldn't very well tell her.
"I did."
Now he lifted the pistol that was cradled in his lap and stood. As he did, the paper he had found on her bedside table fluttered to the floor. He stepped on it as he left the room, his heel landing square across the heading at the top. "Medication Abortion Authorization and Informed Consent," it read. "The Center for Women's Health, Jackson." 8 a.m. With a flourish, Wren set the plate down in front of her father, a fried egg and a drippy candle stuck into a smile of melon.
"Happy birthday to you," she finished singing. "By the way, that would have been way better if I had a sibling. Harmony sucks when you're an only."
"You're overestimating your singing ability," her dad grunted. She laughed.
"Someone's feeling grumpy."
"Someone's feeling old as hell."
She sat down across from him.
40 is the new 20, she told him.
"Says who?"
"Me," she sighed. "I told you you never listen."
He smirked and took a bite of his egg. She didn't have to look at his face to know that it was perfectly cooked. Her dad had been the one to teach her to fry one correctly. The way to ruin an egg was to not be patient and to heat the pan too fast, which would make the egg stick to it. You had to be slow, methodical, deliberate. Wren had lost track of how many times her father had come into the kitchen when she was making breakfast and would automatically turn the flame down. But as much as it pained her to admit it, he knew his shit. The eggs she cooked were works of art. She folded her arms and rested her chin on them.
"So I've been saving this one for today," she said, and immediately he perked up.
For as long as she could remember, they traded facts. Mostly about astronomy, which her father had introduced her to so long ago she couldn't remember not being able to pick out constellations like Andromeda and Cassiopeia and Perseus and Pegasus.
"Astronomers found a massive star that exploded in 1954. And again in 2014.
Her father's eyebrows shot up.
"Twice?"
She nodded.
"It's a supernova that refuses to die. It's 500 million light years away, near Big Bear. Usually supernovas fade over 100 days, right? This one is still going strong after 1,000.
Her dad had taught her that stars needed fuel, like anything else that burned. When they started to run out of hydrogen, they cooled, changing color to become red giants like Betelgeuse. But this star had defied the odds.
"That is an excellent birthday fact," He grinned. What's on the agenda today?
She shrugged. I'm going to check on my meth lab, wire a million to my offshore account, and have lunch with Michelle Obama.